What, his pocket? Then the man had it, a knife from his boot. He stabbed back at David, connecting with his side. David heard his clothes rip and saw the blood on the knife, which was coming at him again. He slid to the side, barely missing the second jab. He moved his hand from the man's back up to his head, and using the cross grip with his arm around the man's neck, he ripped hard. A loud snap rang out, and the man slumped to the floor. David rolled off the dead mercenary and stared at the ceiling, watching two flies chase each other. Chapter 32. Imare Jakarta Headquarters, Jakarta, Indonesia. Martin's men had taken Kate deep underground, then led her down a long corridor that opened onto what looked like a large aquarium. The glass window was at least 15 feet tall and maybe 60 wide. Kate didn't understand what she saw. The scene beyond the glass was clearly the bottom of the Bay of Jakarta, but it was the creatures moving about that puzzled her. At first she thought they were some sort of illuminated sea creatures, like jellyfish, drifting down to the bottom then floating back to the surface. But the lights were wrong. She walked closer to the glass. Yes, they were robots. Almost like robotic crabs, with lights that swiveled like eyes, and four arms, each with three metallic fingers. They burrowed into the ground, then emerged with items in their mechanical hands. She strained to see. What were the items?
Our excavation methods have come a long way.
Kate turned to see Martin. The look on his face gave her pause, worried her. He looked tired, dejected, resigned. Martin, please tell me what's going on. Where are the children that were taken from my lab?
In a safe place for now. We don't have much time, Kate. I need to ask you some questions. It's very important that you tell me what you treated those children with. We know it wasn't ARC-247.
How could he know that? And why did he care what she had treated them with? Kate tried to think. Something was wrong here. What would happen if she told him? Was the soldier David right? For the past 4 years, Martin had been the only man, the only person whom Kate could allow herself to fully trust. He'd always been distant, buried in his work, a legal guardian more than an adoptive father. But he had been there for her when she needed him. He couldn't possibly be involved in the kidnapping, but something was wrong here. I will tell you about the therapy, but I want the children back first, she said. Martin walked over, joining her beside the glass wall.
I'm afraid that's not possible.
But you have my word. I will protect them. You have to trust me, Kate. Many lives are at stake. Protect them from what? I want to know what the hell's going on here, Martin.
Martin turned, walking away from her, seeming to ponder.
What if I told you there was a weapon somewhere in this world that was more powerful than anything you can imagine? A weapon capable of wiping out the entire human race.
And that what you treated those children with is our only chance at survival, our only means to resist this weapon.
I'd say that sounds pretty far-fetched.
Does it?
You know enough about evolution to know that it's not. The human race isn't nearly as safe as we think it is. He motioned toward the aquarium wall, toward a robot floating down. What do you think is going on out there?
Digging for treasure? A sunken merchant ship, maybe?
Does this look like a treasure hunt to you? When Kate said nothing, he continued. What if I told you there was a lost coastal city out there, and that it was only one of many around the world? Around 13,000 years ago, most of Europe was under 2 miles of ice. New York City was covered by a mile of ice. In the span of a few hundred years, the glaciers melted and sea levels rose almost 400 feet, wiping out every coastal settlement on the face of the planet. Even today, almost half the human population lives within 100 miles of the coast. Imagine how many people lived on the coast then, when fish were the most reliable source of food and the seas were the easiest method of trade. Think of the settlements and early cities that were lost forever. The history will never recover. The only surviving record we have of this event is the story of the Great Flood. The people who survived the deluge from the glaciers were keen to warn generations that came after them. The story of the flood is a historical fact. The geological records prove it. And the story appears in the Bible and all the texts we've recovered before it and after it. Cuneiform tablets from Akkadia, text from Sumer, Native American civilizations, they all tell of the flood. But no one knows what happened before it. That's what this is about? Finding lost coastal cities? Atlantis? Atlantis is not what you think it is. My point is that there is so much below the surface, so much of our own history that we don't know. Think about what else was lost at the time of the flood. You know, the genetic history. You know that at least two species of humans survived to the time of the flood. Maybe three. Maybe more. We've recently found Neanderthal bones at Gibraltar that are 23,000 years old. We could find bones that are even younger. We've also found bones that were only about 12,000 years old, dated to around the time of the flood, less than 100 miles from where we now stand, off the main island of Java, on Flores Island. We think these hobbit-like humans walked the earth for almost 300,000 years. Then suddenly, 12,000 years ago, they die out. The Neanderthals evolved 600,000 years ago. They had roamed the earth nearly three times longer than us when they died out. You know the history.
You know I do. And I don't see what this has to do with kidnapping my children.
Why do you think the Neanderthals and the hobbits died out? They had been around a long time before humans walked onto the scene.
We killed them.
That's right. The human race is the biggest mass murderer of all time. Think about it. We're hard-coded to survive. Even our ancient ancestors were driven by this impulse, driven enough to recognize the Neanderthals and hobbits as dangerous enemies. They may have slaughtered dozens of human subspecies, and that legacy shamefully lives on. We attack whatever is different, anything we don't understand, anything that might change our world, our environment, reduce our chances of survival. Racism, class warfare, sexism, East versus West, North and South, capitalism and communism, democracy and dictatorships, Islam and Christianity, Israel and Palestine, they're all different faces of the same war, the war for a homogeneous human race, an end to our differences. It's a war we started a long time ago, a war we've been fighting ever since, a war that operates in every human mind below the subconscious level, like a computer program, constantly running in the background, guiding us to some eventuality. Kate didn't know what to say, couldn't see how it could involve her trial and her children. You expect me to believe those two children are involved in an ancient cosmic struggle for the human race?
Yes.
Think about the war between the Neanderthals and humans. The battles between the hobbits and humans. Why did we win? The Neanderthals had bigger brains than us, and they were certainly larger and stronger. But our brains were wired differently. Our minds were wired to build advanced tools, solve problems, and anticipate the future. Our mental software gave us an advantage, but we still don't know how we got it. We were animals, just like them, 50,000 years ago. But some great leap forward gave us an advantage we still don't understand. The only thing we know for sure is that it was a change in brain wiring, possibly a change in how we used language and communicated, a sudden change. You know all this, but what if another change is underway? Those children's brains are wired differently. You know how evolution works. It's never a straight line. It operates on trial and error. Those children's brains could simply be the next version of the operating system for the human mind, like the new version of Windows or Mac OS, a newer, faster version, with advantages over the previous release. Us. What if those children, or others like them, are the first members of a new branch emerging in the human genetic tree? A new subspecies? What if, somewhere on this planet, a group already has the new software release? How do you think they would treat us, the old humans? Maybe the same way we treated the last humans that weren't as smart as us, Neanderthals and hobbits. That's absurd. Those children are no threat to us. Kate studied Martin. He looked different. The look in his eyes, she couldn't place it. And what he was saying, all the talk of genetics and evolutionary history, telling her things she already knew. But why?
It may not seem that way, but how can we really know? Martin continued.
From what we know of the past, every advanced human race has wiped out every race they viewed as a threat. We were the predator last time, but we'll be the prey next time.
Then we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
We've already crossed it. We just don't know it. That's the nature of the frame problem. In a complex environment, we simply can't know the consequences of our actions, however good they may seem at the time. Ford thought he was creating a device for mass transportation. He also gave the world the means to destroy the environment.
Kate shook her head.
Listen to yourself, Martin. You sound crazy, delusional.
Martin smiled. I said the same thing when your father gave me the same speech.
Kate considered Martin's claim. It was a lie. It had to be. At the very least, it was a distraction, a play for her trust, an effort to remind her that he had taken her in. She stared him down. You're telling me you took those children to prevent evolution?
Not exactly. I can't explain everything, Kate. I really wish I could. All I can tell you is that those children hold the key to preventing a war that will wipe out the human race. A war that has been coming since the day our ancestors sailed out of Africa 60,000 to 70,000 years ago. You have to trust me. I need to know what you did.
What is the Toba Protocol?
Martin looked confused. Or was he frightened? Where did you hear that?
The soldier who picked me up from the police station. Are you involved in it? Toba?
Toba is a contingency plan.
Are you involved?
Her voice was steady, but she dreaded the answer.
Yes, but Toba may not be needed.
If you talk to me, Kate.
Four armed men entered from a side door that Kate hadn't seen before.
Martin turned on them.
I wasn't finished talking to her.
Two guards took her by the arms, forcing her out of the room and down the long corridor she had traveled down to meet Martin. In the distance, she heard Martin arguing with the other two men.
Director Sloan said to tell me your time is up.
She won't talk, and she knows too much anyway. He's waiting at the helipad.
Chapter 33. River Village Slums, Jakarta, Indonesia. David slapped Cole again, and he came around. He couldn't have been more than 25. The young man looked up through sleepy eyes that grew wide when they saw David. He tried to draw away, but David held him.
What's your name?
The man glanced around, searching for help, or maybe an exit.
William Anders.
The man searched his body for weapons, but found none.
Look at me. You see the body armor I'm wearing? You recognize it?
David stood, letting the man take in the head-to-toe Imari battle gear he wore.
Follow me, David said.
The groggy man stumbled into the next room, where his partner's dead body lay, his head turned at an awkward, unnatural angle.
He lied to me, too.
I'll only ask you one more time. What's your name?
The man swallowed and steadied himself in the doorway.
Cole?
Name's Cole Bryant.
That's better.
Where are you from, Cole Bryant?
Jakarta Branch.
Imari Security Select Forces.
No, where are you from originally?
What?
The young mercenary seemed confused by the question.
Where did you grow up?
Colorado.
Fort Collins.
David could see that Cole was coming out of the haze. He would be dangerous soon. He needed to find out if Cole Bryant fit the bill.
Got a family back there?
Cole took a few steps away from David.
Nope.
It was a lie.
Very promising. Now David needed to make him believe.
They go trick-or-treating in Fort Collins?
What?
Cole edged toward the door.
Stop moving.
David's voice was harder.
That feeling at your back? That tightness, you feel that?
The man touched his lower back, trying to slide a hand into his armor. Confusion clouded his face. David walked to a duffel bag in the corner of the room and threw the flap open, revealing several square and rectangular brown blocks that looked like Play-Doh wrapped in saran wrap.
You know what this is?
Cole nodded. I put a small row of this explosive up your spine.
This wireless trigger controls it.
David held his left hand out, showing Cole a small cylinder about the size of 2 AA batteries put end to end. At the top was a round red button that David's thumb held down.
You know what this is?
Cole froze. A dead man's trigger.
Very good, Cole. This is a dead man's trigger.
David stood and slung the duffel bag strap over his shoulder. If my thumb slips off this button, those explosives will go off and it will turn your insides into a gelatinous goo. Keep in mind there's not enough explosive to hurt me or even penetrate your body armor. I could be standing right next to you, and if I were shot or came to any harm, the explosion would liquefy your insides, leaving your hard outer shell just like a Cadbury cream egg. You like Cadbury cream eggs, Cole?
David could see he was really scared now.
Cole shook his head slightly to the side.
Really? They were my favorite when I was a kid. Loved getting those things at Easter. My mom used to even save some to give me at Halloween after I got through trick-or-treating. Couldn't wait to get home and crack one open. The thick chocolate shell, gooey yellow inside.
David looked away as if remembering how delicious they were. He glanced back at Cole.
But you don't want to be a Cadbury cream egg. Do you, Cole?
Chapter 34. Imari Jakarta Headquarters, Jakarta, Indonesia. Martin stepped out of the elevator onto the helipad. The sun had almost set. The sky was red, and the wind at the top of the 80-story building blew in from the sea, carrying the smell of salt water. Ahead of him, Dorian Sloane waited with 3 of his men. When he saw Martin, he turned and motioned for the helicopter pilot to start the takeoff sequence. The engine fired, and the rotor blades started to turn.
"I told you she wouldn't talk," Sloane said.
"She needs time."
"It won't help."
Martin straightened.
"I know her far better than you do."
"That's debatable."
"Say another word, and I'll make you sorry." Martin stepped towards Sloane, now almost shouting over the roar of the helicopter. "She needs time, Dorian. She will talk. I urge you not to do this."
"You created this situation, Martin. I'm just cleaning it up."
"We have time."
"We both know we don't."
"You said it yourself."
"I was quite amused at the other things you said. I assumed you hated me because you hated my methods and plans.
I hate you because of what you did to her,
which wasn't a tenth of what she did to my family.
She had nothing to do with that."
"Let's agree to disagree, Martin, and let's focus on the task at hand."
Sloane grabbed him by the arm and led him away from the helicopter, where it would be easier to talk, and Martin thought, where Sloane's men couldn't hear him.
"Listen, Martin, I'll make you a deal. I'll delay Toba protocol until we find out if this can work. You let us work on the girl. We'll get what we need in 1, maybe 2 hours, tops. If we leave now for Antarctica, we'll have the information by the time we land. We could test a true Atlantis gene retrovirus within 8 hours. And yes, I know you're looking for an entrance."
Martin began to speak, but Dorian waved his hand dismissively.
"Don't bother denying it, Martin. I have a man on the team. Within 24 hours, you and I could walk through the gates of the tombs together. No Toba. This is the only play you have. We both know it. I want your word that she will not be harmed. Permanently harmed.
Martin, I'm not a monster. We just need what she knows. I would never permanently harm her.
We'll agree to disagree on that point. Martin looked down. We should leave now. The Antarctica site is rather hard to get to.
As they walked to the helicopter, Sloane pulled one of the men aside.
Get Taria out of that cell, and tell him to find out what Warner did to those kids.
Chapter 35. Outside Imari Jakarta headquarters, Jakarta, Indonesia. They had driven in silence for almost 10 minutes when David said,
"Tell me, Cole, how does a kid from Fort Collins wind up at Imari Security?"
Cole stared straight ahead, focusing on driving. "You say it like it's a bad thing."
"You have no idea."
"Says the guy who killed my partner and strapped a bomb to my spine." Cole had a point, but David couldn't explain. That would take away his leverage. Sometimes you had to be a bad guy to save the good guys. They continued on in silence until they reached the Imari Jakarta campus, a collection of 6 buildings surrounded by a high chain-link fence, topped with barbed wire. Guardhouses flanked every entrance. David put the helmet and goggles on and handed Cole the ID of the man he'd killed. At the gate, the guard stepped out of the booth and sauntered over to the car.
ID?
Cole handed him 2 Imari ID cards. Bryant and Stevens. The guard took the IDs.
Thanks, asshole. I've only been reading for 40 years now.
Cole held up a hand.
Just trying to be helpful.
The guard leaned in the window.
Take the helmet off, he said to David.
David pulled the helmet off and looked straight forward, then to the side, hoping the side view would pass, that the closer look was just mild professional hazing or the insecure guard pounding his chest. The guard examined the ID, then scrutinized David. He repeated the motion several times.
"Just a minute."
He hurried back to the booth.
"That's standard?" David asked Cole.
"Never happened before." The man had the phone at his ear. He was dialing, his eyes glued to the 2 of them. David drew his gun and reached across the car in 1 fluid motion. The guard dropped the phone and reached for his gun. David fired a single shot, hitting the man in the left shoulder, just above where the vest ended. The man collapsed to the ground. He would live, but his attitude probably wouldn't improve. Cole looked over at David, then gunned the car toward the main Imari headquarters building.
"Park at the rear entrance, near the boat landing."
David reached into the back seat and grabbed a small pack filled with explosives. He pulled the duffel bag with the remaining charges into the floorboard. In the distance, they heard the wail of sirens erupt across the campus perimeter. They entered the building through an unguarded loading dock door. David placed a charge on the wall next to the door. He punched a code into the detonator, and it began beeping. It was hard to do one-handed, but he had to keep his thumb on the trigger for Cole's sake. They moved down the hallway, and David placed additional explosives every 20 feet or so. David had opted not to tell Cole anything before they arrived. His captive could have found a way to communicate the information to Imari HQ, or they could be intercepted. Either way, there was no upside. Now he had to explain.
"Listen, Cole. They're holding a woman somewhere in this building. Dr. Kate Warner. We need to find her."
Cole hesitated for a moment, then said, "The holding cells and interrogation rooms are in the middle of the building, on the 47th floor. But even if she is there and you get her out of the room, you'll never get out of the building. Security is on its way here now, and there are already dozens of guards in this building alone, plus field agents who've returned."
Cole motioned to the dead man's trigger in David's left hand.
"What happens to me if you..."
David thought.
"Is there any field ops equipment in this building?"
"Yeah, the main armory on 3, but most of the weapons and armor are gone. The entire field regiment was deployed to kill you today."
"It won't matter. They wouldn't have taken what I need. When we have the girl, I'll give you this trigger."
You have my word, Cole. Then I'll make my own way out.
Cole nodded once, then said, There's a service stairwell without cameras. One thing before we go.
David opened a supply closet and lit a fire. In seconds, the flame licked up the wood racks toward the smoke detector on the ceiling. Fire alarms called out around them as flickering LED lights punctuated the din, and pandemonium broke out. Doors opened, people ran from rooms left and right, sprinklers sprang to life, and water soaked the fleeing masses. Now we can go.
Chapter 36 Imari Jakarta Headquarters, Jakarta, Indonesia. On the elevator, Kate had fought at the guard's vice-grip hold on her arms. They pinned her to the wall until the elevator doors opened, then hauled her into a room with what looked like a reclining dentist's chair. They threw her down, strapped her in, and sneered. "The doctor will be right in." They all laughed as they walked out. Now she waited. Her initial relief at seeing Martin felt like a million years ago. Fear started to grip her. The wide straps cut into her arms, just above where the zip ties had gouged her wrists. The room's walls were stark white, and except for the chair, the only thing in the room was a steel high-top table with a round bundle on it. She could barely see it from the reclining chair, which forced her gaze up toward the buzzing fluorescent lights. The door opened, and she craned her head to see. It was him. The man who had taken the kids, the man who took her from the soldier's van. A wide smile spread across his face. It was a mean smile, the kind that said, "I have you now." He stopped a few feet from her face.
"You've gotten me in a lot of trouble today, little girl. But life is about second chances."
He walked over to the steel table and unrolled the bundle. Out of the corner of her eye, Kate could barely make out the gleam of steel utensils, long and pointy. He glared back at her over his shoulder.
"Oh, who am I kidding? My experience, life is about payback."
He took out one of his tools of torture, a smaller version of a grilling skewer.
"You're going to tell me what I need to know, and I hope it takes as long as physically possible."
Another man came in. He wore a white coat and held something Kate couldn't see, possibly a syringe.
"What are you doing?" he asked the torturer.
"Getting started. What are you doing?"
"That's not the plan. We use the drugs first. Those are the orders."
"Not my orders."
Kate lay there, helpless, as the men stared at each other, the torturer holding the silver prod, the white coat clutching the syringe. Finally, syringe man said,
"Whatever. I'm going to give her this. Then you can do whatever you want."
"What is it?"
"Something new we're using in Pakistan. Basically turns their brains to mush. They'll tell you anything."
"Is it permanent?" the torturer asked.
"Sometimes. Been lots of different side effects. We're still working on it."
He jammed the oversized syringe into Kate's arm and injected slowly. She felt the cold liquid fill her veins. She fought against the straps, but they were too tight.
"How long will it take?"
10, maybe 15 minutes.
"Will she remember?"
"Probably not."
The torturer set the silver tool down and walked over to Kate. He ran a hand down her chest and legs.
"So cute and feisty. Maybe they'll let me have you when they have their answers."
Chapter 37 Kate didn't know how long it had been. Didn't know if she had been asleep or if she was awake now. Her body didn't hurt. She couldn't feel the straps. Couldn't feel anything. She was so thirsty. The lights were blinding, so bright. She turned her head to the side, licking her lips. So thirsty. The ugly man was in her face. He grabbed her chin and jerked her back into the light. She squinted, his face so mean, angry.
"I'd say we're about ready for our first date, princess."
He pulled something out of his pocket, a sheet of paper.
"But first, we need to get some paperwork out of the way. Just a couple of questions. Question number one.
What did you give those children?
He pointed at the paper.
Ah, we have a footnote here. We know it wasn't ARC-247, whatever the hell that is.
They know it wasn't that, so don't even try it.
So what was it?
Final answer, please.
Kate tried to fight the urge to respond. She shook her head side to side, but in her mind's eye, she saw herself in the lab, preparing it, worrying that it wouldn't work, or that it would harm their brains, turn them to mush. The drug they had given her. She had to...
What was it? Tell us.
I gave... my babies.
He leaned over her.
Speak up, princess. We can't hear you. Operators are standing by to record your answers.
I gave... couldn't... gave my babies.
Yes, that's it. Gave your babies what?
Gave my babies.
He sat up.
Jesus, you guys hearing this? She's fried.
He closed the door. Time for Plan B. He did something in the corner of the room. She couldn't focus. Then an alarm, and water, falling from the ceiling. Lights flashing, even brighter than the lights before. Kate squeezed her eyes shut. How much time had passed? A loud sound. More of them. Gunfire. The door exploding. The ugly man fell, bloody. They unstrapped her, but she couldn't stand. She flowed out of the seat onto the ground like a child going down a water slide. She could see him, the soldier from the van, David. He wore a backpack. He handed another man a small device. The other man was scared. He put his thumb on the device. Their voices sounded muffled, like Kate was underwater. The soldier took her face in his hands. Soft brown eyes met hers.
Gate?
Danview Cheerby?
Gate?
His hands were warm. The water was cold. She licked her lips. She should have drunk some. Still so thirsty. He jumped up. More gun blasts. He left. He was back.
Danview Foot, your harms? Her round me?
He held her arms, but she couldn't move them. They fell, lifeless, to the ground. They were made of concrete. He darted back to the door and threw something. He picked her up in both his arms, strong arms. He ran. Ahead of them a wall of glass and steel exploded. Shards hit her, but they didn't hurt. They were flying. No, falling. He held her tight, with only one arm now. He reached back, trying to get something. Then they were yanked back, caught on something. She flew, fell from his arms, but he held her by one arm. She dangled as he glided above, suspended by strings from a white cloud. His grip was slipping. She was too wet. Her clothes were wet. She was falling. He trapped her with his feet, digging into her back and ribs. His hand moved up her arm, and finally he wrapped both legs around her. She faced down now, and she saw them. Men, gunfire, below. The building and the docks were filling with them. More men ran out of the buildings and began firing, beeps above. The bottom of the building exploded, throwing shrapnel and pieces of the soldiers into the parking lot. Ripping sounds above. They fell faster now. The man wiggled, and she felt them flying away, moving farther out over the bay. More sounds below, motors cranking and more gunfire. They twisted around, and she saw the marina swarming to life. Rapid beeps above. A car in the parking lot winked out of existence, sending a wall of flame and smoke hundreds of feet around it, engulfing everything and everyone. The gunfire stopped. It was quiet, peaceful now. She saw the last rays of sunlight set over the Java Sea as darkness fell. They hung there for a time. Kate didn't know how long. Above, she heard another rip, and they were plummeting to the Black Sea below. Kate felt him struggling, reaching for something. The legs around her slipped. They finally lost their grip, and she was falling faster, by herself. Seconds passed in slow motion. She rolled as she fell. Saw the man floating above her, floating away from her. She heard but didn't feel the loud crack as the water engulfed her, pushing her down, now pulling her down. Water, cold salt water, was in her mouth and her nose, and she couldn't breathe, could only suck in water. It burned. The darkness was almost complete, just a glimmer of light at the surface where the moon kissed the sea. She drifted now, arms at her side, eyes open, waiting. Waiting. She fought not to breathe more water. Her mind went blank. No thought, only cold water, all around her, and burning in her lungs. A flare, a burning stick falling down, too far away from her. And something swimming at the surface, too far away. Another flare, closer, but still too far. The creature bobbed its head below, swam, and then went back up for air. A third flare, and the figure dived down toward her. It grabbed her and pulled her, kicking violently toward the surface. They would never reach it. She took another gulp of water, had to, needed air. It invaded her, felt like cold concrete being poured down her mouth, and it pulled at her so hard, not letting her rise. And the moon was there, and then everything was so dark. She felt the air now, the wind and the droplets of rain, heard the splashing around. The splashing went on so long, and the arm was around her, keeping her up, her head out of the water. There was a loud sound, a huge boat with lights. It would hit them. It was coming straight for them. She saw her rescuer wave his hands and pull her out of its path. Another man, hands pulling her up, and she was on her back, and her rescuer was over her, pressing on her chest, pinching her nose, and he kissed her. His breath was so hot. It filled her mouth and pushed into her lungs. She kissed him back, and it made her so happy. She hadn't done that in so long. She fought to lift her arms, but she couldn't. She tried again, and yes, she reached up, tried to hold him, his mouth to hers. He pushed her arms away, held them down. She lay there, and then it exploded. Her chest. Water gushed from her mouth and nose as he rolled her over. The water kept coming in coughs and gags. Her stomach spasmed, and she drew air in desperate breaths. He held her until her breathing slowed. Every breath burned. Her lungs still wouldn't fill. Every intake was shallow. He yelled out to the other man,
"Ardo! Ardo! Tights! Tights!"
He drew a hand across his neck in a cutting motion. Nothing happened. He got up and marched away. A second later, the lights went off and they were moving, fast. The rain whipped at her face, but she just lay there, unable to move. He picked her up again just as he had carried her out of the tall tower. He took her below and laid her down on a small bed in a cramped room. She tried to reach for him again, but he was gone. Then back again, then gone, appearing and disappearing as if by magic. She heard voices, saw him pointing at a man.
"Ardo, plop, plop!"
He pointed again. Then he came for her, collecting her in his strong arms, and they were off the boat, on land again. They walked along a beach toward a wrecked town like something that had been bombed in World War II. They were inside some kind of cottage, and the lights were on. She was so tired, couldn't stay awake a second longer. He set her down on a bed of flowers, now a comforter with a floral pattern. She closed her eyes and almost went to sleep, but she felt him at her feet, pulling her wet pants off. She smiled. He reached for her shirt. Panic. He would see it. The scar. His hands gripped the shirt, but she held them, struggling to hold the shirt down.
"Gate. View half du foot try blouson."
"No."
She shook her head and turned over. "View half."
She could barely hear him. He tugged at the shirt.
"Please don't," she mumbled. "Please don't."
Then he was releasing her. The weight on the bed shifted, and he was gone. The motor started, a small one, and warm air was around her, on top of her. She twisted, and it warmed her stomach, her hair, her whole body was warm. Chapter 38. Imari Jakarta Headquarters, Jakarta, Indonesia. Cole lay on his stomach waiting. He had been waiting for almost an hour as the bomb tech fiddled with his vest. He fought not to squirm, not to lose control of his bladder, not to scream. One thought ran through his head over and over. I'll never see my family again. He should have never taken the job, regardless of the money. They had saved almost enough, $150,000 of the $250,000 they needed to open a Jiffy Lube. With his money from two straight deployments with the Marines, they would have been fine. But he wanted to have a little extra saved, just in case business was light those first few years. The Amari recruiter had said, "You're mostly there for show, to make our clients feel safe. As you requested, we'll assign you to a low-security region, definitely not the Middle East or even South America. Europe requires seniority. Southeast Asia has been very quiet. You'll love the weather in Jakarta." Now some other Amari suit would be knocking on his wife's door. "Ma'am, your husband was killed in an unfortunate Cadbury cream egg incident. Our deepest condolences." "What? Oh, no, ma'am, this never happens. Here are his cream egg remains." Cole let out a harsh, almost irrational laugh. He was losing it. "Hang in there, Cole. We're almost in," the bomb tech said, from behind a thick, curved blast shield. The man wore a bulky helmet and peered through a glass strip at the top of the blast shield. His arms jutted out through two silver accordion-type metal arm sheaths that looked like the arms from the robot on the 60s TV show, Lost in Space. The tech carefully cut the straps on Cole's back vest. He lifted the vest slightly and bent closer to the glass slit in the blast shield for a better look. Sweat drops popped up across Cole's already soaked face. "It's not booby-trapped," the tech said. Inch by inch, he peeled the vest back. "Let's see what we've got." Cole almost jumped when he heard the man throw the vest the rest of the way over. Was there a timer? A backup? He felt the man's hands working quickly at his spine. Then he felt the gloved hands go limp. He heard the screeching of metal on metal as the tech forcefully slid the blast shield out of the way. He worked with his bare hands now. Cole felt the man lift the bomb off his spine. "You can get up now, Cole." Cole turned, holding his breath. The man looked at him with contempt. "Here's your bomb, Cole. Be careful now. You could be allergic to polyester." He handed Cole a rolled-up T-shirt. Cole couldn't believe it. He was embarrassed, but mostly, he was relieved. Cole unrolled the T-shirt. It read in big black magic marker letters, "Boom." Below it, in smaller print, "Sorry." Chapter 39. Batavia Marina, Jakarta, Indonesia. Hardo put his arm around his wife and gathered his son and daughter at his side. They stood on the wooden dock at the marina where Hardo had retrieved the boat the soldier had told him about. The four of them beheld the machine, no one saying a word. It sparkled. It all still seemed like a dream to Hardo. The boat was the most beautiful thing he'd seen since his youngest child was born. "It's ours," he said.
"How, Hardo?"
"The soldier man gave it to me." His wife ran a hand along the boat, maybe to see if it was truly real.
"It's almost too nice to fish in."
The boat was a mini-yacht. At 60 feet, it was capable of travel between the small islands off Java. It could hold up to 30 people above deck, and sleep as many as 8 below deck in the master stateroom, port guest room, and aft guest stateroom. The upper deck and flybridge would give breathtaking views. "We're not going to fish with it," Hardo said. "We're going to take others fishing. The foreigners living here and the tourists. They pay lots of money for this, to go fishing in the deep sea, and for other things, diving and touring the islands." His wife looked from Hardo to the boat, then back again, as if trying to assess whether it would work, or maybe how much work it would be for her.
You going to finally learn English, Harto?
I'll have to. There aren't enough fish in the sea to feed all the Jakartan fishermen. Entertainment is the future.
Part 2. A Tibetan Tapestry. Chapter 40. Somewhere off the Java Sea. That night, Kate dreamed that she had been kidnapped by her wicked uncle. She had been riding in an iron chariot with a knight and his men. Her uncle had smashed the chariot and killed the men, casting her knight out into the darkness. Her uncle had taken her to his castle and locked her in a dungeon, deep below the castle walls. He prodded her with questions, demanding she reveal her most secret of secrets. She knew if she told him, he would eat her children and become a powerful monster, a monster no one could kill. He told her lies, then more lies, believable lies. She wanted to believe them, but she resisted. The more he said, the more she questioned. Did he kill her father? Was her whole life a lie? His men took her from the dungeon into a tower. They strapped her down and gave her a potion, and she felt herself transforming. It was eating her will from the inside out. Just before it took her over completely and she lost the power to resist, the knight kicked in the tower doors and killed her captors. He lifted her up, and he flew away, casting fire and death down on their pursuers, who shot arrows from below. But the castle moat was too wide, and they fell into the treacherous water. She was lost, sinking, but he rescued her again, pulling her from the abyss. His kiss brought her back to life, and she was so happy. Happy to be free from her uncle, and happy it was the knight who had rescued her. The knight's loyal friend rode them far, far away, to a deserted isle with a small cottage. The knight carried her ashore and set her down in a bed of flowers, where the warm wind lulled her to sleep. Kate awoke to the worst headache of her life. It hurt to move. She lay in the bed for a moment, swallowing several times. Opening her eyes hurt. The sunlight hurt. She turned over away from the window. The window? The bed? Where was she? She pushed herself up, and with each inch she moved, the pain spread across her. Her body was sore, but it didn't feel like the soreness from exercise. She felt like she'd been beaten all over with wooden spoons. She felt sick, hurt. What happened to me? The room came into focus, a cottage or some kind of vacation home on the beach. The room was small, with one double bed and some rustic wooden furniture. Out the window she saw a large porch that opened onto a deserted beach. Not the pristine, well-kept kind you saw at resorts, but the type you might find on a real deserted island. A rough, unkempt beach, littered with coconuts, tree bark, tropical plants, and here and there dead fish that had washed up from last night's violent rain and high tide. Kate pushed the covers off and moved slowly to get out of bed. A new sensation gripped her. Nausea. She waited, hoping it would pass, but it only got worse. She felt the saliva gathering at the back of her throat. She ran for the bathroom, barely making it in time. She collapsed to her knees and dry-heaved into the toilet. Once, then again, and a third time. The convulsion sent shockwaves of pain through her already ravaged body. The nausea receded, and she rolled off her knees to sit by the toilet, propping an elbow on the toilet seat and resting her hand on her forehead.
"At least you don't have a walk of shame ahead of you."
She looked up. It was the man from the van, the soldier, David.
"What are you? Where are we?"
"We'll catch up later. Drink this."
"No, I'll just throw it up."
He bent down to her and tipped the orange concoction toward her.
"Give it a try."
He held the back of her head, and she realized she was drinking it before she could object again. It was sweet and coated her raw throat. She drank it down, and he helped her to her feet.
There was something she had to do. What was it? Something she had to get.
Her head still pounded. He helped her into the bed, but she stopped.
Wait, there's something I have to do.
We'll get to it. You have to rest.
Without another word, he maneuvered her into the bed, and she felt so sleepy, like she had taken a sleeping pill. The sweet, orange elixir.
Chapter 41. Imari Corporate Jet, somewhere over the southern Atlantic Ocean. Martin Gray leaned toward the plane window and peered out at the giant iceberg below. The Nazi sub jutted out of a mountain of ice near the center of the floating island, which covered almost 47 square miles, about the size of Disney World. Where the sub met the ice, workers and heavy machinery were hard at work, excavating, searching for the sub's entrance. Cutting into the side was a last resort, but it would come to that if they didn't reach the hatch soon. The wreckage below the sub was even more mysterious. Teams were still working on theories. Martin had one of his own, an idea he would take to his grave, if necessary.
"When did you find it?"
Dorian Sloane's voice startled Martin, and he turned to see the younger man standing over him, gazing out another window of the jet. Martin opened his mouth to respond, but Sloane interrupted him.
"No lies, Martin."
Martin slumped in the chair and continued squinting out the window. 12 days ago.
"Is it his?"
"The markings are the same. Carbon dating confirms the age."
"I want to go in first."
Martin turned to him. "I wouldn't advise it. The wreckage is likely unstable. There's no way of knowing what's inside. There could be..."
"And you're coming with me?"
"Absolutely not."
"Now, Martin, where's that intrepid explorer I knew in my youth?"
"That is a job for robots. They can go into places we can't. They can withstand cold, and it will be cold in there. Colder than you can imagine. And they're easier to replace."
"Yes, it will be dangerous."
"Even more dangerous, I think, if I go alone, with, say, you left outside." "You assume I'm as morally bankrupt as you are?"
"I'm not the one kidnapping kids and keeping secrets."
Sloane leaned back in the chair across from Martin, readying for a fight. A steward entered their compartment and said to Sloane, "Sir, there's a call for you. It's urgent." Dorian picked up the phone from the wall.
"Sloane."
He listened, then looked up at Martin, surprised.
"How?"
A moment passed.
"You can't be serious."
He nodded a few times.
"No, look. He had to leave by boat. Search the surrounding islands. They couldn't have gone far.
Deploy everyone. Bring in troops from local Imari security and secured clock tower cells if you have to." He listened again.
"Fine, whatever. Use the media to box them in. Kill him and capture her. Call me back when you have her."
Sloane hung up the phone and scrutinized Martin as he said,
"The girl got away. A clock tower agent helped her."
Martin continued surveying the site below. Sloane put his elbows on the table and leaned close enough to strike Martin.
50 of my men are dead, and 3 floors of Imari Jakarta have been blown to pieces, not to mention the wharf.
You don't seem surprised, Martin."
"I'm looking at an 80-year-old Nazi sub, and what could be an alien spaceship sticking out of an iceberg off the coast of Antarctica. I'm hard to surprise these days, Dorian."
Sloane leaned back. "We both know it's not an alien spaceship."
"Do we?"
"We will soon." Chapter 42. Somewhere off the Java Sea. For a while, David leaned against the doorframe in the bedroom, watching Kate sleep, waiting to see if she would wake up again. The Imari thugs had really put her through the ringer, and his rescue of her hadn't exactly been gentle, either. Seeing her sleeping there while the waves rolled in and the breeze blew through the room somehow put him at peace. He didn't understand it. The fall of Jakarta Station in the face of an imminent terror threat, from the very people he had dedicated his life to stopping, was a nightmare scenario. No, the
nightmare scenario. But saving Kate had affected David in some way. The world felt less scary now, more manageable in some way. For the first time since he could remember, he was hopeful, almost happy. He felt safer. No, that was wrong. Maybe the people around him were safer, or he felt more confident. Confident that he could protect the people he... The self-analysis would have to wait. He had work to do. When it was clear Kate wouldn't wake up again anytime soon, he withdrew from the room and resumed his work in the hidden chamber below the cottage. He had told the contractors he wanted a bomb shelter. They had said nothing, but the looks they gave each other said it all. This dude is crazy, but he didn't argue about the price, so get to work. They had given the room a strong post-apocalyptic end-of-the-world motif. All concrete walls, a utilitarian built-in metal desk, and just enough room for a small bed and some supplies. It was fitting, given his situation. His next move was crucial. He had deliberated about what to do for most of the morning. His first instinct was to contact Clock Tower Central. The director, Howard Keegan, was his mentor and friend. David trusted him. Howard would be doing everything he could to secure Clock Tower, and he would definitely need David's help. The issue was getting in touch. Clock Tower didn't have any backdoor communication channels, just the official VPN and protocols. Those would no doubt be monitored. Connecting would paint a target on your location. David drummed his fingers on the metal desk, leaned back in the chair, and stared at the light bulb hanging from the ceiling. He opened a web browser and scoured all the local and national news. He was procrastinating. There was nothing here that could help him. He did see a wire release about a woman and man sought in connection with a terrorist plot and possible child trafficking ring. That could slow him down. There were no sketches attached to the article, but they would follow shortly, and every border security agency in Southeast Asia would be on the lookout for both of them. David had several IDs in the safe house, but not much cash. He opened his bank account. The balance was almost zero. Josh had executed the transfers. Was he alive? David had assumed Jakarta Station HQ was attacked when he had been in the streets. There was something else. Several deposits, all small. Less than $1,000. All even numbers. It was a code, but what kind? GPS? $9.11. $50.00. $31.00, $14.00, $76.00, $9.11, 9.11. That would be the start and end of the code. The rest, 50.31.14.76, an IP address. Josh had sent him a message. David opened a web browser and typed in the IP. The page was a letter from Josh. David, they're outside the door. It won't hold much longer. I decoded the messages. Click here to read them. I couldn't figure out what they meant. I'm sorry. I did find the contact, online at least. He's using the Roswell Craigslist board to pass messages. Click here to go there. I hope he sends another message, and that you can stop the attack. I'm really sorry I couldn't help more. Josh. P.S. I read your letter and executed the transactions, obviously. I thought you were dead. The sensor on your suit showed no vitals. I hope that doesn't mess you up. David exhaled and looked away from the screen for a long moment. He opened the file with the decoded messages. Obituaries from the New York Times. In 1947. Josh had done some great work. And he had died thinking he'd failed. David opened the Roswell Craigslist site, and he saw it immediately. A new message from the contact. Subject: running down the clock on a tower of lies. Message: to my anonymous admirer. I'm afraid my current relationship has become complicated. I can't meet you or have any contact. I'm sorry, it's not me. It's you.
You're too dangerous for me. There are 30 reasons and 88 excuses I've come up with not to meet you. I've run through 81 lies and 86 stories.